Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everyone. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder, for those that are joining us live, make sure and join the chat room over at the show page with the usual suspects. If you have some observations are some questions you would like for us to address to our guests, please roll them in right there, and we'll do our best to fold them in as the show goes forward. And if you're new to Midrats, or if you want to catch up on the shows you've missed, you can always come on over to the show page on Blog Talk Radio, listen to it there, or you can take the cheap route and get the free podcast over on iTunes. Now let's get on with the show. The history of the Earth, it's a constant story of changing climates, whether you're talking about temperature, sea level, deserts, rain. There's a lot of arguments about what causes what, but the one thing we do know, it does change. And anyone who has read Hopkirk's book, Foreign Devils on the Silk Road, the Icelandic Grönlandssaga saga, or for that matter, look out the window when flying on the East Coast on a clear day, the fact that the climate changes and the results that that has on what humans do and where they go, it's obvious. It drives migrations, both internal and external. Wars are fought because of it. And the question is, are we doing all that we should to monitor the Earth so decision makers and our national command authority and also international organizations can plan and perhaps mitigate some of the impact as the Earth makes its changes? And our guest today for the full hour to discuss the topic will be Research Associate and Joseph S. Nye, Jr., Internship Coordinator for the Center for New American Security, CNAS, for those that like these acronyms. He's also the co-author of what's going to be the touchstone for our discussion, a policy brief from CNAS called Blinded, the Decline of U.S. Earth Monitoring Capabilities and Its Consequences for National Security. Will Rogers, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Appreciate it, Will, and I would encourage everybody over at my homepage, our Eagle Ones for that matter, you can find a link to the PDF. It's a quick read, and it gives you a good overview of one of those little underlying issues that a lot of people miss in their scan, like most things involving intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance. And, Will, what I wanted to give you a chance, if you could, just give people a thumbnail sketch of the topic that you and your co-author covered in Blinded.
Sure, no, and thanks for the opportunity to do that. So our report is really, it stems from our work that we've done on looking at how natural resources and environmental change engage our national security and foreign policy interests. You know, in the work that we've done over the last few years, we found that the Department of Defense and others in the national security establishment are increasingly looking at environmental and climate change trends and integrating this information into their decision-making to understand the way that the environment and environmental trends engage political, social, socioeconomic, and cultural trends in places around the world that we have national interest in. And so what our report found is that the United States is, you know, depending more and more on satellite systems for managing the way it's approaching unconventional threats in the 21st century, and this is particularly true for satellites that monitor climate change and other environmental trends that more and more policymakers are coming to rely on to inform their policymaking processes in order to plan effectively for global climate change and other environmental challenges that are likely to rear their head in the future. But our ability to understand these challenges is being compromised by our declining Earth monitoring capability. What my co-author Christine and I found is that networks of satellites, ground-based sensors, and UAVs are the very assets that we rely on to monitor and understand environmental change, and its consequences are going dark. And I think in a very crisp example that we give in the report, by 2016, only seven of NASA's current 13 Earth monitoring satellites are expected to be operational, leaving a crucial information gap that will hinder national security planning. And so it's a problem that's not new, and it's actually been reported on for years, but we're increasingly alarmed that the broad security and foreign policy communities don't sufficiently understand how climate and environmental data from the satellites that we're losing affect our national security planning. And that's really the thrust of it. And so we offer some what we think are practical solutions for the way ahead, including leveraging our international partners through science and technology agreements, and also in bolstering our own capabilities here at home so that we have the capability to provide the unique information that U.S. national security planners need to prepare for the future.
Well, let's go a little slowly through this, because I'm kind of an old-timey guy who remembers the first satellite that we threw up in the sky, and the Russians had their first one up. Right now, we have a certain number of satellites. I think you've been identified 13. They're used for some purposes, and then we have other satellites that are more specific for intelligence gathering and all that. And the ones you're most concerned with at this point, and in this paper, are Earth satellite that we use to monitor the conditions of the deserts and the oceans and the ice caps. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a host of other instruments that these environmental satellites have that are specific to them, that our other intelligence and other communication satellites don't have and are not likely to have in order to provide the information that we need.
Well, as you look at these satellites, then let's say we're talking about we're concerned not just with you're taking it in a much more global sense than the weather satellite that might warn of a hurricane or an impending typhoon that would strike Bangladesh, which seems to be the prime target for cyclones in the Indian Ocean area.
Right.
But you're much higher than that. I mean, it's like we see the desert expanding in the Sahara, or we're seeing the glacier melt in the Himalayas, for those of us who grew up in a different time. And that's going to cause a problem downstream. Can you kind of and I want you to relax, because you're going a little fast for me here, but can you kind of discuss how this all works?
Sure. No, and that's I'll slow down and relax for you here. But so the environmental satellites that we rely on today, they can do the things that you're talking about. They can do projections and early warning for cyclones that might strike Bangladesh, but they also, if we have a steady stream of information coming from them, we can piece together that information and understand changes in the global environment. We can understand where and how the Arctic might be ice-free in, say, 30 years. And so we're able to do longitudinal data surveys using the same information that we're collecting that would also be applicable in the near term. And again, a lot of these environmental instruments are specific to environmental satellite systems that our intelligence capabilities and other satellite systems that we currently have don't provide us. So it's sort of a...
That'll work. I think one other thing that I got out of the report, that once you read it, you kind of go, of course. But somebody coming up from the side, when you say Earth monitoring, people think, oh, weather satellites. But when you're talking about Earth monitoring, it's a lot more than just looking at satellites and where the edge of the ice shelf is. There are other things these satellites and these monitoring systems are looking at besides that. Kind of flesh out the depth and the multiple areas that we're talking about when we use that overall phrase Earth monitoring.
Sure. The notion of Earth monitoring refers to, I think, broadly how we interpret the way that environmental change is happening around the world. And so I think an apt example would be the way that USAID and other development agencies use the famine early warning system and the associated sensors to understand not just how and when crops are failing in parts of Africa, for example, but how those changes are going to drive migration and create other instances of instability that might undermine stability in places that we have inherent interest in. There are we rely on satellite satellite for telemetry up in the Arctic to understand how the Arctic will be opening. We use ocean surface vector winds or instruments and satellites to measure ocean surface vector winds, which are play a key role in regulating the Earth's water and energy. So there's a whole, I mean, it's very technical, and it's, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm answering the question sufficiently, but...
You're getting there. I think one of the interests was that the it gets more, and it goes to, when I was a kid, I was fascinated. Now, I'm not quite as well seasoned as my co-host. I'm
thank you.
I'm an early cohort Gen X type. So, and I grew up in a place where I could watch the Saturn V take off. Which, by the way, the late great space shuttle and all the junk they put up right now are just toys compared to Saturn V's. But I was utterly fascinated by when the National Geographic put out the Landsat photos. And as I look back at it in time, it's amazing that the information they got from Landsat and the artificial color, which showed, you know, how land was being used in different parts of the world, all that was done in 60s and 70s technology. And you zip up today, and y'all mentioned the CubeSats, and there's a lot of great technology here. But the ability to create, disseminate, and analyze data due to our advanced technology is huge. But it kind of set me back when you mentioned there that of the Landsat satellites, there's only two that are remaining, one of which is a past its due date, so to speak. So we just have one that is really up there and reliable. And that loss of an ability, I believe they're trying to get it back next year. Are there other systems out there that can give people, whether you're talking about USAID or people that are doing long-range trend studies on human migration and land usage, that are going to be able to have access to that type of raw data that Landsat would give us?
Well, there really aren't, and that's the problem that we're trying to find a solution to. You know, the information that Landsat, these photos that they produced in the 60s and 70s, and that you saw, you know, growing up, the instruments that were able to provide that information have been failing on some of these satellites. They're past their service lifetime, so you might have there is a Landsat, one of the two that's still in orbit, but it doesn't have the same capabilities that it had in the 60s and 70s. And you're right that the Landsat data continuity mission is planned for next year, early 2012. But there's not, these satellite systems provide unique capability, each one of them do. There's not a lot of redundancy and overlap. And so when the satellite systems fail, the information that's unique to them is not being generated and it's not going into the and to provide steady data stream for policymakers to understand, you know, where the capability gap is going to be.
Out of that, how long does it, if we were going to replace the failing Landsats or the already failed Landsats, how long would it take us to put something to do that in orbit, and what is the current situation? What is in process of being getting ready to be sent up there?
I don't have a complete list of everything that's being ready to get ready to be sent up there, but it takes anywhere from 5 to 10 years in order to replace a failing satellite system. So the GAO put out a report last year that actually very nicely has a chart that shows where the capability gaps are going to be, and you're actually seeing that some satellite systems there will not be, you know, the service will be discontinued, and there will be a gap of several years before the next satellite system is put into orbit to provide the information that the previous satellite was generating. And this, you know, really presents a problem for national security planners who need access to a steady stream of data to generate the kinds of information, actual intel, that they need to understand ways that the environment and climate change are impacting areas around the world.
Another thing that you cover in the report that is distressingly familiar, I know you've seen it at the political level with your experience in the Senate, and I saw it down at the tactical and operational level as I tried to make USAID, Department of State, IOs, NGOs, and other governmental organizations try to work together as a team, that we have the same problem here with our satellite systems, where NOAA, NASA, DOD, they all have broadly similar requirements, but they have failed for a variety of reasons to be able to work together and now are inefficiently going on their own separate paths. What, and you know, we can put out pronouncements saying y'all play nice in the sandbox together, which I think they, the president has done, but that really doesn't achieve us anything. What is causing the inability inside of our own national lifelines to get DOD, NASA, and NOAA to work together? Is it funding and Rice Bowl issues? Is it personality issues? Or they just can't get their different requirements to line up so they can work together to really achieve the same thing?
No, that's a great question. I think you hint, it's a little bit of what you just addressed. There are funding issues, there are personality issues, and there's no real overarching driver. And it's a typical issue that we have in Washington with people in the interagency not playing well with each other. There are specific capabilities that NASA and NOAA want that DOD says it doesn't need, and vice versa. Competing priorities, and when you have, you know, a satellite system can't be everything to everyone, and so you're having interagency partners that they're required to make trade-offs, but no one wants to make those trade-offs.
Is it in the military, when we're doing a joint operation, something at the theater level, even the tactical level, you have a system called supported and supporting. The supported is the lead, the supporting people answer to them. Has there ever been a system worked up that said, NOAA, you are the supported agency, DOD and NASA, you're supporting, and is it a leadership issue? Did they try to do this by committee, or we just really don't know the background on it?
No, I think, well, there hasn't been a program where DOD is secondary and NOAA takes the lead or NASA takes the lead. DOD NASA and NOAA seem to play together a lot better. And you've seen this with some of the programs that NOAA runs are run by NASA and vice versa. But I think part of the challenge too in getting cooperation at the interagency level is just what the information is going to be used for. And so, again, going back to the requirements issue, DOD requires certain capabilities that NOAA and NASA don't want. You know, and I also wonder to an extent and I don't have anything to base this on, but there are classification issues in the interagency that seem to suggest that, you know, DOD wants to be able to have this access to this imagery and to classify it, while NOAA and NASA would benefit from having to be open source. And have scientists that are able to access it. Again, I don't know that that's necessarily the case, but it's not a stretch of the imagination from what I've seen.
Sure. Eagle One?
Well, that raises an interesting point, because I think in your paper you point out that at least one instance, the National Polar Orbiting Operational Environment Satellite System, what was it, NEPOS, that failed. And instead of having one satellite,
they split off and had
two. Now we're going to have two, which is immensely inefficient.
Right.
Is there any good reason for that, other than they just can't get along, or is it, as you said, the requirements are just too different, and they can't really discuss, they can't get it together?
Well, I do think it is the inability of the interagency partners to work together. I think the idea behind the NPOESS project was that you could have a tri-pronged interagency satellite system that all three of them could wield and have their priorities met. But again, with problems in the interagency, we saw that the program fell apart. And I think you saw the disbanding of it into two different projects as an alternative to the entire project being canceled altogether, especially because the project was meant to provide a capability gap for some of NOAA, NASA's, and DOD's current satellite systems, including defense satellite meteorological program that DOD runs that provides actionable intelligence to theater commanders about weather systems and in places like Afghanistan and other places. And so I think it was a decision that was made that you were either going to have two projects or you were going to have nothing and then no data streams coming in to provide the information that these practitioners needed for planning.
A question that always comes on the military side, I think, is pretty applicable here too, and that has to do with what type of international cooperation and interaction do we have when it comes to Earth monitoring? How is the level of international cooperation? And there is, unlike the 60s and the 70s, there is a greater group of people who are throwing satellites up there. Are we working together well on the international level, or is that the same level of dysfunction that we have inside our own national lifelines?
We're working a little bit better. We have, you know, but international cooperation, especially on the science and technology side, is something that's been underutilized, especially with a lot of our international partners that have these satellite capabilities that we either have that are declining or that we don't have yet. But again, you know, one of the things that we looked at in our report is this this infrastructure, this international infrastructure known as GEOS, the Global Earth Observation System of Systems. And the idea behind this is that you'd have a repository of information being populated by international agencies to provide information that a lot of different international partners could share. But what people in the U.S. government who were relying on this were saying was that we're not getting access to the information that we need to prioritize, or specifically for our U.S. national security planning. And that's sort of where, you know, where these efforts fall short, is that the United States has specific national priorities and national security interests that it needs unique information for, that other partners, whether they be the international or even in the private sector, are just not providing.
If I don't know whether in your time in the Senate you ever had a chance to do a CODEL to Japan, but one of the neat things about the four deployed naval forces from the U.S. and Japan is the fact that in some areas we actually have the same watch floor. The U.S. military and the Japanese military, within the defined boundaries, work together real well. When I was reading the report, I thought of these combined watch floors that we have. The mention of the Deep Ocean Assessment and Report, a tsunami satellite that I believe is mostly interested in what's going on around Hawaii and Wake and the American Islands. But it seemed to me that that would be a perfect environment for the U.S. and Japan to work together to monitor the Pacific. Is Japan involved in this, or do they have their own national systems? In your research, did you ever come across at least a bilat relationship with the Japanese for tsunami monitoring?
Specifically with Japan, I hadn't. We, NOAA's Deep Ocean Assessment and Reporting Tsunamis Program, the DART program, they share information with international partners like Japan. I haven't seen any specific bilateral programs that the United States and Japan have around tsunami early warning. But I agree with you, though, that this is the kind of low-hanging fruit that we're talking about, where international cooperation is sort of ripe for providing, you know, both U.S. and Japanese asset or information capability that both nations need, especially around tsunami and early warning and disaster preparedness issues. There are mechanisms. I mean, we have existing science and technology cooperation agreements with Japan and other international partners that we're just not leveraging effectively to ensure that we, you know, leverage the assets they are currently investing in for our own benefit.
Yeah, it would seem to be a no-brainer that if the Americans are spending $200 million on X and the Japanese are spending $200 million on X, if we could do a combined operation. Yeah, and instead of and save $150 million, and we'll split the difference and throw a party, bring a, you know, a keg of sake, and we'll call it even. Eagle One.
Well, how much of the situation that we're in now is caused by the failure of some of the satellites we did have designed to go into space to either fail to launch or just to crash? You know, they get up there. They don't work. They fall out of the sky. How much of what's going on is caused by that type of failure?
That's a great question, and we have had, you know, some pretty significant technical failures, in the, or especially in the last few years. In 2009, NASA's Orbiting Carbon Observatory, which was designed to map global carbon dioxide levels, it crashed into the Pacific Ocean after right after it launched because a protective shroud failed to separate from the rocket, and it actually added extra weight that prevented the satellite from reaching orbit. You know, and this exact same thing happened 2 years later in March 2011, just this past March. You know, the protective shroud was substituted for a protective nose cone for NASA's GLORY satellite, which really hailed as the next generation of climate monitoring satellite. It's just to study things like black carbon, for example. But it again crashed after it was launched from Vandenberg into the Pacific Ocean. And so you're seeing that we're, you know, some are pointing to this as a decline of U.S. edge, especially on the technology front. Very simple things that we could be doing to make sure that these things don't happen. It is a problem, and it's something that we, you know, addressed in our paper.
Yeah, it seems to me that years ago I was reading about these really long-range, stay-up-forever sort of drones that were going to be used for a lot of these purposes. Whatever happened to that stuff, and could they be used as a stopgap measure while we wait for more satellites to go up?
No, that's a good question too. And those kind of UAV systems, they provide, you know, a modicum of support for the environmental and climate information data collection that we need. The Air Force actually was doing similar things by retrofitting C-17s down in Antarctica and doing aerosol samples by flying around because we didn't have a satellite capability to provide the information that the C-17 was able to provide. But these are, like you said, these are stopgap solutions that don't really provide an adequate amount of information. A lot of the things that we're talking about, DOD and other national security policymakers need for their planning are longitudinal data sets that we can only get from polar orbiting or other high orbiting satellite systems that can do long-term surveys of environmental and climate change trends that will inform the way that we understand the changing environment 20 or 30 years from now.
Well, you mentioned the black carbon monitoring. Two nations came to mind, you know, two of the world's largest producers of the dirty carbon, the soot, and, you know, general polluters in for a lot of different areas, is India and China. And the nation with the greatest, at least territorial and economic interest in the Arctic, is Russia. And what do these nations do to monitor the Earth's changes and what they're doing to it? Are they just free riding on the work that the U.S. and maybe the European Space Agency is doing?
I don't know specifically what the Chinese, Russian, or Indian space programs look like. I know that the Indians have invested in satellite capabilities in order to understand a whole range of environmental and climate change trends. I would suspect that the Chinese and the Russians have similar capabilities, but I don't know for sure. Like I said, I know specifically that the Indians, they do have that kind of capability.
Somebody have a fire alarm going off?
Yeah, that would be on my end.
Well, if you have to run off to the street, we'll cut you some slack and shit, man. I don't want you to burn.
Well, no, this happens every once in a while.
Is the Heritage Foundation sieging CNAS or something?
It could be.
Eagle One, I'm sorry. Eagle One?
Oh, that's all right. I just lost my train of
thought. Well, while Eagle One tries to find his brain, let me throw this your way.
Hello.
Oh, you back?
I think so. I was laughing so hard I unplugged my headset. You know, these highly mechanical devices sometimes fool me. In addition to, well, one of the other things you point to in this article is an over-reliance on a system that I think is GOESS. Can you explain what that system is and why we're over-relying on it?
Sure. I was sort of hinting at it a little bit earlier. It's the GOESS is the Global Earth Observation System of Systems, It's an international program for sharing and analyzing environmental data. It's this, what I was mentioning earlier about how we have international partners who would populate the data set, and then we would all be able to reap the benefits from it. In part, this reliance is due to the budget cuts that we've seen that prevent the U.S. government from investing in its own capabilities. And so GEO seemed like a sensible solution. But the system, in our interviews with folks, the system lacks key technical mechanisms that would actually make it user-friendly and interoperable among the international partners that we're working with. And again, going back to my other point, it doesn't provide all the data necessary to meet U.S. policymakers' unique information needs. Information that U.S. military and foreign policy planners need would be specific for the United States, and we might not be able to get it from the information that, say, the Indians or the Japanese or whoever else is participating in GEOs are using to are populating the information database with.
When you throw out some numbers and some funding numbers, I think, you know, in an environment where everybody's talking about trillions and billions seem like a rounding error. I mean, millions is almost couch change. That's what we're looking at here. And as with anything, it's money is the key. But to access that money, you need to have the right knowledge base and sponsorship in Congress, in the House and Senate. And when there's a military problem that comes up, people can usually mention one or two congressmen or senators are no going to get involved. If there's ever a Navy or Marine Corps issue, people will think of, you know, Senators McCain or Webb might be an expert to tap on. When we're talking about Earth monitoring, satellites, reconnaissance and surveillance, who are the power brokers in the House and the Senate, or, you know, the belly buttons you need to press in order to move these things forward? Or is this one of those areas that we just don't have the intellectual depth there that we need?
No, it's the latter. We don't have there isn't a natural constituency for these kind of programs in the House or Senate. Not one that has been is very identifiable the way that Webb and McCain are, as you said, for defense issues. And part of it, I think, is that there's just not a real appreciation for looking at these systems as national security assets. You know, and that's really what they are. They're not unlike DDGs and the littoral combat ship. I mean, you know, it's a hard sell. I understand, but these are national security assets that, and we need to think about them and give them the same consideration that we do with other national security programs. But, you know, policymakers on the Hill are not doing that right now. They're, you know, in this budget environment, they're not thinking in terms of what are these systems and how are they going to enable U.S. national security interests. And the part of our effort, you know, in the work that we do here at CNAS is to try to educate policymakers and help them understand that these are the assets they need to ensure that the United States is able to secure its national interests in the future.
Well, along those lines, does the DOD weigh in on these national security assets? Are they out there plugging along with CIA and a whole alphabet soup of intelligence agencies saying we really need to have these things, and here are 80 good reasons why, or is this just being, you know, just a subset of other military requirements?
I'm not sure that DOD and others have been very vocal about it. There's a growing constituency in DOD for an appreciation of these systems. You know, back in 2008, the National Defense Authorization Act required that the Department of Defense look at how climate change will impact its facilities and missions. And DOD, in its 2010 Quadrennial Defense Review, started looking at climate change as a national security challenge and actually integrated the climate change into its 2010 QDR. But to do that, it had to create a nascent infrastructure of both civil service and career military officers who understood what the requirements would be on the Department of Defense and why and how environmental and climate change issues were engaging DOD's traditional missions. And so I think there's a growing constituency in DOD for this. I haven't seen anyone be completely vocal. I haven't seen, for example, the SecDef or the CNO come out batting for these, in light on the Hill. It's not a stretch of the imagination to see them doing that as these issues become more pertinent and more important for the department, especially where policymakers are going to need access to this information over the long term.
Over in the chat room, Will, one of our regulars here, Ken, he had a good question here. I thought I'd roll out there. And you have a couple different ways you could answer it, is because a lot of what we're talking about here to really get quality data, you know, you can never say, well, this happened last year and this happened this year. You know, 2 points don't make a trend when you're looking at these issues. You really need some long-term monitoring. And do we have a good handle on a stable set of collection requirements that we need as a nation in order to inform policymakers? Or because we really, every year, as I think your report outlines very well, have a classic high-demand, low-density asset, and are some gaps that we're seeing developing because we're being driven by current research identifying new things, you know, the trend of the year to monitor that's pulling on these limited assets?
That, no, that's a great question, and thanks to Ken for asking it. And that's exactly right. Is, you know, 2 points don't make a trend. We need access for 20 or 30 years to understand a longitudinal trend that's happening. We don't have sufficient understanding of where the gaps are. The climate scientists that I speak to, you know, they're able to develop trends and by mapping, and they rely on information that's steadily available for them. But part of the challenge that we're seeing here is that a lot of the places that we're looking at, some of the data doesn't exist, especially where some of our national security interests are at stake. You know, the climate science is pretty steady in areas that they've been studying for 20 or 30 years, and they're able to develop these long-term trends. But in places like, and the Arctic's one of those areas where climate scientists just happen to be, and they've been able to map changes in ice density. But, for example, in places like the South China Sea, where ocean salinity is affecting fish migration patterns and other, a host of other environmental challenges, we don't have the long-term data, access to the data to understand where these trends are going. And so I think you're seeing people move into that space. But one of the challenges that we're facing, and this goes back to educating policymakers why they need to invest in this capability and why they need to understand environmental and climate change trends as national security challenges, is that, you know, policymakers, they want access to information today. They don't want to wait 10 years for a study to be done to understand how climate change may affect changes in fish migration in the South China Sea, because they need to make a decision about the South China Sea today. And so you're just seeing a disconnect between what climate scientists are able to produce and what policymakers are actually asking. And this is sort of one of these fundamental gaps that exist between those two communities. And it's something that we really need to work on in order to develop the relationships that will be necessary to ensure that policymakers can go to people and say, this is the information I need, and with the understanding that they're not going to get it tomorrow, we're creating a demand signal, essentially, for information where U.S. national security planning is going. And I think it goes back to, needing to today develop long-term priorities. We know the South China Sea is a great example of where we've just turned our attention, but I think part of the idea of integrating environmental and climate change trends into our long-term national security planning is to develop these priorities so that we know we're going to need this information 20 or 30 years from now, and then pointing scientists in the direction to collect data or information, generating that demand signal so that when policymakers are faced with some of these critical questions 20 or 30 years down the line, the information will be there.
When you look at all this stuff, and I keep thinking back to the early days of World War II, when we were looking at invading places like Guadalcanal, and the maps we had at the time were, you know, dated back to the 1900s or maybe even 1890s.
Right.
And I'm impressed to see that we have the same problem going on now, that the information, we don't know what information we'll need 10 years from now, but we have to start planning for it today, which is, I think, what you just pointed out. And what is your recommended path forward? What is the solution to this problem you've identified?
Well, I think, you know, harking back on a point that I made, I think it is developing long-term priorities, you know, pointing to specific areas where we can generate a demand for scientific information that will inform our future national security planning. And not being very ad hoc about it. And I think you're seeing a concerted effort among national security practitioners, especially in the Department of Defense. You know, the U.S. Navy has been pretty forward-leaning when it comes to planning out for where it sees itself engaging in the future and where it needs information in order to help its decision-makers, you know, adjust and identify what assets it needs, et cetera. but I haven't seen anything done that looks long term at 20 or 30 years from now. What's the state of the world? What are policymakers going to be confronted with, and what information are we going to need? And so I think we need to first just start with developing priorities. I mean, that's how, you know, a lot, we fall down a lot on strategy because we fail to identify priorities. We just are very ad hoc about things. But if we want to talk about developing a long-term strategy that integrates environmental and climate change trends effectively with our national security and foreign policy interests in mind, it means that we need to develop priorities, you know, today. And there are mechanisms that we can leverage that to do that. The National Intelligence Council, for example, would be a great way to start. They have a rich history of being able to look long term. We're not leveraging those assets effectively.
Yeah, I think it's especially for people that have spent some time in the national security area. I mean, the requirements and the importance of being able to look forward and to know what your environment is in a literal sense in this case. And just, I mean, Eagle One's example of Guadalcanal was spot on. You know, for instance, when in the late 80s, if somebody told you that we would have been in Afghanistan for 10 years, you go, oh, no, you're talking about the Soviets. Like, no, I'm talking about us. It's going to happen. You never know what the future is going to bring. And there's really no question about the importance. And I think what's sad in many respects, and I think one of the challenges that we're going to have here, is this requirement has become very politicized. And a lot of the blame or credit, depending upon how you look at it, I think started with our former vice president, I'll avoid mentioning his name just not to draw it into the topic. And when you mention client scientist now, that doesn't have, like somebody says, marine biologist, or somebody says theoretical physicist. It's not a neutral term anymore. It has a political angle, because I think what we've seen in the last decade and a half, we saw people who have been following the issue. You saw the verbiage shift from global warming to climate change when facts became uncomfortable. And we've seen a discredit of a lot of the discussion and a lot of the climate scientists because of the fraud that took place at East Anglia University that has kind of smeared both the good and the bad. And there's a body of people who are doing what many people have done throughout millennia, trying to gain power, and have been using climate research and climate prediction to gain political power in order to pursue other agendas. And as a result, this whole desire to investigate and to make plans for what the Earth has done since its beginning, which is change, has become politicized. What would you see would be the best way to try to divorce this political smear over an important issue away from the national security requirements, which really should be apolitical and fact-based? Because right now there's some overlap there that I think politically is going to make it difficult for those who want to get support to get the broad range of support for this that you really need to do this long-term.
Sure. I don't think there is as much of a challenge today as there was a few years ago. I agree with you that climate science is inherently politicized, we typically don't have to re-adjudicate the climate science to folks that we speak to in the national security community, and precisely for this point. And it's because we're able to point to observable changes in the environment that the U.S. Navy, the Coast Guard, and a host of other military practitioners are feeling and observing and are experiencing now, in order to tell the story of why environmental and climate change science is important for their long-term decision-making and planning. You know, you look at the Arctic, and this is an area of the world where there are measurable changes in the Arctic ice concentration that the U.S. Navy is acutely aware of, so is the Coast Guard. And there are a host of other examples, you know, that we can point to. But I think cutting through, you know, and part of it, I think, is that with science, and it's not just climate science, it's any kind of science, it's that, you know, scientists are very they're objective, and they're very clear about not being 100% certain about something. And just because there's a little bit of doubt doesn't mean that the science is flawed. And I think that's where a lot of the politicization of climate science comes in, is that you're looking at, you have climate scientists who are saying that we project that by 2030 the Himalayan glaciers, you know, may retreat you know, into the into Central or South Central Asia. But there's inherently some equivocation there because nothing in science is 100% certain. You know, we can cut through all that. We can cut through the political chafe by saying, here are the observable changes that are happening in the Arctic and in other places of the world. This is why our attention needs to be, you know, on environmental and climate change trends, because, you know, the Department of Defense gets this, is that these trends are, they serve as a threat multiplier. They're engaging our other political, socioeconomic, and cultural and ethnic, you know, trends that are occurring in places around the world, and that the, you know, the environment may not be ever the sole precipitator of conflict, or but it can be the straw that breaks the camel's back. And I think you're starting to see those, the notion of that resonate with not just military personnel, but security practitioners, whether it's in, you know, USAID or in the State Department or in the intel community. And we can get through that again by pointing to some of the observable changes that are happening in the world today.
Yeah, the fact that I don't have a glacier outside my house is fairly evident that things have warmed up sometime in the past, and perhaps that trend is continuing. I mean, it seems to me a lot of the discussion gets wasted on whether the cause is purely man-made or is deeply contributed by man, or whether it's just a natural process. It doesn't really matter. The end result is what counts. If the oceans are rising, if the Arctic ice is melting, you know, that's a situation we have to deal with, and it doesn't matter what, I mean, at this level, on the national security level, it doesn't really matter what the cause is per se. It matters that it's happening, and we have to deal with the results of that, which reminds me that historically this has happened before by other causes. The Irish potato blight famine, we ended up with mass migration as a result of that. And I guess you see the same sort of thing as possible out of some of these changes that are viewed through these satellites. Is that a fair statement?
I'm sorry, that political
migrations.
I'm sorry, I keep cutting you off.
Well, I think I'm finished. I was going to try and encourage you to talk. So.
Sure. No. I mean, so there are a range of things that cause migration to happen: political, social, and economic circumstances, cultural, ethnic circumstances. But the environment does play a role, and that's what we're starting to get a better handle on: is that the environment does engage these other trends in ways that do have a profound influence on them. And so, in places such as, you know, Yemen, for example, the declining availability of water is, you know, undermining the legitimacy that the Yemeni government has from its people. And so these are kind of environmental trends. These are the ways that we're seeing them engage and shape political circumstances. And so I don't think it's a stretch of the imagination to, you know, to say that the environment does play a role in affecting political and social contexts in a way not unlike the Irish potato famine. But, you know, and we're seeing some of these issues, you know, arise in other areas of the world. I mean, the South China Sea, again, I'm going back to this example because it's one that's constantly in the news. You know, we look at tensions between Vietnam and China largely as a grievances associated over fish stocks and resources, but we don't have an appreciation for how those, it seems almost simplistic to say, well, it's just, they're just arguing over fish. It's not, there's no geopolitical implications involved, but there are, especially given that, you know, you look at the broader environmental trends that Vietnam is dealing with, including climate change and the saltwater intrusion along its shores and how it's destroying some of the aquaculture in Vietnam, and that, you know, sea fisheries are going to be extremely important for the Vietnamese in the future and for their overall food security. You're starting to see hints at how these environmental trends can shape the geopolitical context in a way that is actually making national security and foreign policy practitioners here at home very nervous.
In the course of your research, I wonder if you had a chance to read something on, with the decline and disappearance of the space shuttle, and I know when you go to Central Florida on the space coast, it's the unemployment coast. There are a lot of extremely educated and intelligent people who are looking for a line of work. And like any other industry, you know, we've had a couple of guests on here to talk about the state of shipbuilding. With satellite development, and anything involving space, there's a certain industrial capacity that you need to have to be an ongoing concern. And there's also the intellectual capital. Neither of them are static that you can put in a box and then access when you want later. And is there much a discussion about the potential loss of that industrial and intellectual capital? If that does take place, is there also some opportunity there? Because there's been a fair bit of critiques about NASA. It's become very hidebound, focused on non-core area subjects. Whereas if you do a little bit of seed money, you can have some very young, sharp people in their 20s create things like the CubeSat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's anytime you have a discontinuation of a program, you run the risk of losing your competitive edge, especially over as other countries are investing in these capabilities and are moving forward. We are seeing, though, that we can leverage the academia and others in the private sector to continue that. The technological development, and the CubeSat is one great example. But I think, like anything, there is a real concern that when you discontinue a program, whether it's a traditional military asset or something like climate satellites or other manned space vehicles, that you're resetting essentially, and that you can't just pick up and have the capability the next day. And we've spoken to people in the industrial defense sector here in the U.S., and these are concerns that they have through discontinuation of certain defense assets and programs, especially on the shipbuilding side. But, I think that, again, there's also a knowledge, there is a brain drain, I think, in the sense that a lot of educated people are moving overseas or moving into the private sector, and so the U.S. government's ability to harness the intellectual power, we could see a decline, but I'm rather optimistic that, at least on the satellite side, that we'll continue to see the steady stream of people interested in this field on the science and technology side and who are being educated. So I'm not too worried about it, but I do take your point that we are seeing some worrying trends, especially on the science and technology side around competitiveness. I think I just saw something recently where the United States is losing more people who are Americans educated here in the United States in science and technology trades to overseas companies or who are moving abroad or living abroad to find work. And it's a worrying trend, and something that, not just the Obama administration, but any administration moving forward is going to need to look at what are the things that we need to do to ensure that we have the science and technological capability and competitive edge to not only provide, provide the assets that we need in the future for our own planning, but also to just give the United States a competitive edge and, in competing internationally.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned shipbuilding as one of those concerns where are we losing our capability. There used to be some federal agency, I had a professor when I was getting my master's degree who worked for it, that was concerned with that very topic, that they met and they discussed what were the vital organs of industry that we needed to keep and maintain our edge. And I don't remember hearing about that in a long time, and I'm curious if there is such an agency anymore and whether they worry about the shipbuilding, and shouldn't they also be worrying about this satellite problem? Do you know?
I don't, but I'm wondering too, to the extent that we'll have to see a renewed conversation in this area, especially given that a lot of defense programs right now are on the chopping block as Congress goes through and starts trying to decide which programs and assets it needs to continue in the future. And I'm not exactly sure how much of that is going to be integrated into those conversations. So I think it's a concern that definitely merits consideration. And I think I certainly encourage people who are in a policymaking position to try to understand how the whole life cycle process of defense applications, and not just understanding that when I think we're narrowly focused on we've ended a defense program, we save money, we lose some jobs, but there are, and going back to the shipbuilding example, there are things that we lose, such as the industrial base competitiveness that we just can't regain overnight by restarting a program.
Hey, Will, as we're coming up with just a little more than 5 minutes left in the show, I just wanted to give the listeners a heads up that you're not a one-trick pony. You have other areas of interest that you've done some research on, and I'm going to throw you a curveball here. A because it's my show and I can do that. But the one of the areas that you've worked in is cybersecurity, and one of the topics that we've touched on a few times today is, you know, the DoD, you know, working and researching an area that isn't quite clearly what you would think would be Department of Defense related, you know, climate monitoring, things of that manner. But a little over a year and a half ago, I saw then Vice Chairman General Cartwright do a speech on cybersecurity that I found rather disturbing, with the enthusiasm that a lot of people have in the uniformed military of becoming involved in domestic security, in this case, domestic cybersecurity. And that's kind of been a hot potato between the uniformed and civilian sides of really trying to get their arms around who really needs to take the lead in a domestic cyber attack where you might have somebody in uniform going after some dude in Atlanta. What is your take on that little balance that we see between the uniformed military and the civilian security sector in cybersecurity, and where that trend is going, and are we really where we need to be?
Well, I think on the DoD side, especially with Cyber Command being stood up, you're seeing more that DoD is trying to fill the role of what they're defining as active defense and protecting the United States from threats from external threats. And on the active defense side, you're seeing a concerted effort by DoD, especially folks at Cyber Command, to go out and prevent malicious software or code from entering DoD networks and compromising those assets. I think on the home front, though, I think it's still an interesting question, but I think there's more stock being put into DHS. And I know that's a crazy concept to think of, because the history of DHS it's not been great since it was stood up as a department, you know, in the early Bush administration. But a lot of folks that we talk to, especially in the cyber realm, say that, you know, DHS is still grappling with a lot of the is still grappling with quite a few bureaucratic and organizational challenges. For one thing, they have 80 something committees on the Hill that they have to go and report to. And so there's no streamlining yet, and so that's one of the bureaucratic issues that DHS is dealing with. But we're reassured by people who are working in the cybersecurity arm of DHS that they're getting around to certain requirements, and they just haven't had time to show that they can perform at the level that they need to help secure the nation's networks from cyber attacks. And I think, yeah, as time goes by, you're going to see more emphasis put on DHS to perform well. And from everything that I've seen, in DHS is you know, cued to be able to perform pretty well domestically. And so I don't see a trend happening where DOD, I'm not even sure it's illegal for DOD to be able to produce or to go and police networks here on the home front. I mean, the problem with cyber is that, you know, they might think that they're, you know, policing somebody in Atlanta who's actually a Chinese person who's using an Atlanta-based server.
Exactly.
And so the legal authorities there become a little bit murky at best. I think for all intents and purposes, though, for Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security is going to be the agency in charge of, you know, helping preserve America's networks at home. But again, it's an interesting question. I don't know exactly how the legal authorities are going to address that issue. You have, you know, the Posse Comitatus Act that prevents the Department of Defense and military from performing any police action here at home. But again, how do you address that if it's a Chinese attack that's originating from China being using an Atlanta server to attack DoD networks? It's becomes a legal distinction that I think not that they're thinking through. I just haven't seen anything very public about it. So
always another topic that is going to generate a lot of paper over the years. And Will, we're coming towards the end here. I want to thank you a lot for coming on this Sunday afternoon to talk with us. It's been a very quick hour. What's next on your research plate?
Right now we're looking at the UN Convention on the Law of the Seas and what the United States can do to, or what we can specifically do to help the Senate, encourage the Senate to move towards ratification, and why it's actually inherently in our national security and economic interest to do so. That's a little project you'll see coming out from the center over the next in the next few weeks or so.
Well, that's a topic of interest. I look forward to reading that along with others, and thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much, and thanks to both of you for the opportunity to come on today, and apologies for the fire alarm. It's been going on and off, so I hope that hasn't been too big of a disruption.
Not at all. Thanks a lot, Will. Really enjoyed talking to you.
All right. Thanks again.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us live. And please check in again with us next week for another episode of MidRats. And I hope you all have a great Navy Day.
It's a long way to Tipperary.